When I finished South Africa, I think I had nearly five near-death experiences. Most of my near-death experience was me being unprepared because of the environment. I got cerebral malaria, which is the worst kind of malaria you can get. This was the river crossing. I had walked 15 hours. I finally made it to this river. As soon as I took the first step and this water just sucked me straight under. And eventually I got to the top. I ran so fast up the shore. I dropped on my knees. I screamed and yelled so loud. It was just like a roar. And I arrived at the hotel. The owner finally comes up to me. He's like, "Where have you just come from? You, my bro, crossed this river. Every year, two people die from this river. You, my friend, had crossed it at nighttime." It was such a highlight of my trip. Definitely the story that like lives with me forever. Right. Hello, hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, I'm good. Where are you calling from?
So I'm in Toronto right now.
Oh, where are you originally, where were you sort of born and raised?
Where was I born and raised? So born in Turks and Caicos Islands, but when I was a baby, I moved to Germany. So I lived in Germany for quite some time, about 10 years. And then I moved back to the Caribbean, and then from the Caribbean, I moved to Canada. So I've lived here for about 23 years now.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much for doing this. I'm very excited to sort of dig into your story. I was like going through a bunch of your clips from your walk across Africa. Like that was freaking amazing.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Where are you calling from?
I'm from Sydney, Australia.
Okay, nice. Got lots of friends there.
Oh, when's the, have you done any sort of expeditions or challenges in Australia, or have you just sort of just came as a tourist?
Not yet. That's definitely on the list of things to do, 100%.
So how I first came about you, Mauro, like I've been really getting into sort of adventurers. I've been reading books from like Reinhold Fiennes, Mike Horn, and I've always been into adventure, and then you sort of popped up of one of the lists of, you know, the modern day adventurer, and then I found out about your trip. I'm walking over 3 years across Africa, and I was watching all those clips. I saw footage of like guns being fired, and you're sort of like, what the hell is happening? And that's how I first came about you, Mara, and that's how we set this up.
Wow, very interesting. Yeah, I think I saw your first messages or your first message by your assistant on Twitter, and I hardly use my Twitter account, so that message was probably just sitting there for quite some time.
I'm glad we were able to get it through. Mauro, please sort of give the audience a bit of an intro of who you are, and I guess about what you're currently focusing on at the moment as well.
Yeah, so I consider myself an eco-explorer. An eco-explorer is essentially, you know, doing what other explorers do, venturing into new places, fascinating places, or leading people into these places, whether it has to do with entertainment purposes, research, scientific research, or just an expedition to become the first person to do something. And so the reason I put eco in front of it is because of, you know, what I've explored in Africa. It really encouraged me to look at things from a more sustainable approach. And so I put eco in front of explore because it allows me to focus my exploration around the sustainability of humanity moving forward, as well as our environment.
How'd you get into exploration, Mario?
I guess it would have started with my trip to Africa, and then obviously the 2.5 year walk that you know spanned the entire length of the African continent from Cape Town to Cairo. And I think even the training leading up to it kind of allowed me to kind of venture into a new field that I was unfamiliar with, that I made myself become competent as I was going along this journey, covering over 18,000 kilometers. So you can imagine with the varying terrain all the way from monsoon seasons, desert crossings, you know, it allowed me to understand and learn how to survive in these places, but also to become an advocate for each place that I was at, in the sense of, you know, really recording and telling stories from the perspective of the local people that were in each of those places. So if I was in Cape Town, I would, you know, hang out with people from Cape Town, Capetonians, and I would give them, you know, basically this kind of like feature in my story of walking across Africa to tell me and my audience what their culture and what their drive is all about.
What was your history prior to doing that 2.5 year journey and that training period? Like, what did you do prior?
Yeah, it was definitely not about exploration. I kind of fell into this without even knowing really what exploring is all about. All I knew is that I was interested in doing something ridiculous and crazy, such as walking the length of Africa, and not even sure that I would be able to complete such a feat, actually. And even just to do one country alone is kind of crazy. You know, like when I finished South Africa, I think I had nearly five near-death experiences, and then each country was, no less, if not more, life-threatening than South Africa. But prior to that, I was a professional track and field athlete. I ran for my country, Turks and Caicos Islands, at the time for about 5 years. And I traveled around the world actually doing that. And I think that's where my spark for culture and humanity really came out, especially when I did a particular championships called NACAC Championships, NACAC. And it's essentially the North American, Central American Championships for track and field. So you had some of the top athletes in the world come together at this championship. And it was actually in El Salvador at the time when El Salvador had just come out of this sort of civil unrest. And, I was there for about a week where I didn't have to do anything. So I decided to just venture around and explore El Salvador completely by myself. And, I just rented a taxi, and I just gave him some cash, and I said, like, show me around. And from that point on, I started my travel career quite late, but I think I was around 23 years old when I did this journey in El Salvador. And that kind of really like started to fuel my curiosity for, well, what else is out there? Who are the people that we live amongst on planet Earth? Because they're so fascinating. They had taken me into their homes. They had been so kind to me, and the entire, not the entire time, but at the beginning of my trip in El Salvador, when I gave this taxi driver this task to drive me around, I had no plan. I just said, just take me to your favorite places. He essentially, took me to these places I would have never gone to my own self, like to his home, to his favorite restaurant. That's like this little tiny shack, but the food was incredible. I was like, whoa. This was not in any brochure in the hotels. And I, and you can see that from that point on, it just became like a kind of snowball effect where I just continued to search for more and more adventures. But, like most people, I just kind of fell into the trap of that 9 to 5 everyday life that everyone kind of falls into, and the fear of uncomfortability, of not being in your home, not being safe in your city amongst your friends and family. And I was essentially, I don't want to call it a victim of that, because some people very much enjoy that kind of life, and I think for good reason. But for me, it wasn't really fitting for how I saw myself in relation to what I should be doing. So I guess at age 29, I had what do you call it? When you lose your mind, sort of. It allowed me to dig deeper and really start to make a decision, left or right. Do I continue going on in this life that serves very little purpose to me? Or do I choose a life that actually fulfills all my life's, not wantings, but purpose in a sense? And so I took the big leap, and I think that's a lot of people's fears, including definitely my fear, which is to leap into the thing that is really your calling card. And so I answered that call, and by my 30th birthday, I landed in Cape Town. I gave myself the gift of doing this incredible trip on my birthday. And I figured 30th birthday is the perfect time to do it, because this is the age in which you're still very young, and but yet you still have the maturity to have the discipline to do complete such a expedition.
Yeah,
That's the
that's
full story. I mean, not the full story, but that is the the longer version of the answer that you may have been looking for.
Thank you for sharing that, Mario. What did the training period look like? Did you do that prior to your birthday, prior to flying out? And then how do you practice and train for a 3-year walk?
So I started walking anywhere from 2 hours to 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, just little walks around my city in Toronto. And before I lived in Toronto, I lived in Hamilton, which is a nearby city about 70 kilometers away. And I decided, like, hey, you know what, let me walk back to Hamilton, this place where I first grew up in Canada. And I thought this would be such a trip that would mean so much to me. It would be a sentimental kind of journey for me to experience that. And I told some friends this, and they thought I was crazy. And I was like, I never really had the full idea that I'm going to walk the entire length of Africa yet. I just knew that I wanted to do something that would put me in a situation where I have to thrive, survive, and cross various terrain. And walking from Toronto to Hamilton is quite easy. It's just pavement all the way through. And so I did that with a heavy backpack. I put some weights inside. I was wearing Converse shoes. I'll never forget the amount of pain that I went through just to like, even just not even halfway there, I think a quarter way to Hamilton from Toronto, I started to have this like this incredible this aching pain, cramps. I think I was having massive cramps in my thighs, my hamstrings, glutes. And I thought to myself, like, this is insane, because this is kind of the distance I would have to cover every single day, but I eventually did make it. So I actually made it to Hamilton, and to me that was the feat I needed, because I needed to understand, I knew my physical body would be able to do it, because I just came from being a professional track and field athlete. My body is fine. I never questioned that whatsoever. It was the mind that I needed to, that I really needed to train, that I needed to not just train, but I needed to find out if I'm capable of doing these ultra long walks that is required to do something like that. And then I had a friend of mine named Donna Foster, who actually reached out to me and said, I want to make sure that you're gonna, do this trip well prepared. And as a professional walking coach, she's an endurance walking coach, it is my duty to make sure that you're gonna be prepared for this. And so what she suggested was that I walk from Toronto to Montreal, which is roughly 550 kilometers. And she would join me for the first 4 days. And it was really an incredible experience, because I've never experienced anything like that. I've never done any long distance running. I've never done more than 5K. I would never walk more than a few hours, like in the city, as I said before. I've never done like proper hikes, never camped, never owned a backpack or hiking shoes, any of those things. That was just completely alien to me. I was just a city boy, former, professional track and field athlete who's like retired. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready to call it quits and just work 9 to 5 like everybody else. But what ended up really happening was, Donna Foster really taught me the skill of maintaining patience throughout these ultra long walks. Like, we're talking anywhere from 10 to 18 hour walks, where if you're starting to walk past 18 hours, you could start hallucinating. You start seeing things, you start feeling pains that you've never experienced before. You start going through hallucinations, as in like everything you wish you were experiencing or wish you were in right now may come out as a hallucination. And it was a tough journey, because we tried to do this in record time. And then after the fourth day, Donna just, left me alone. She said, meet me in Montreal, which is where I met her and her husband, who were waiting for me. And I had to do the rest of the walk on my own. So there was another 10 days that I had to do. So it took me about 14 days to do this walk. And it was a really beautiful experience, because I learned so many new things about myself that I was capable of doing, like camping out at nighttime. This was during the fall, by the way, where when I was camping, there was literally ice on my tent. And I was just like, this is insane. But that was the training I needed to understand my body physically, but also, and most importantly, was my mind. I needed to understand how my mind would be in many different kinds of situations. If I'm, like on this walk, I witnessed two accidents. Like I literally saw in front of my eyes a car skidding out and landing in a ditch. Like it was bizarre and wild. I experienced almost dying, as in like, when I said I was in the tent and was frozen, I had to sleep in that tent and I was not prepared for that kind of weather. So I essentially had to stay up all night to prevent myself from freezing to death. So I was doing planks, drinking water, exercising. I was doing low squat. I was just essentially just trying to expend as much energy to keep my body going and to keep the fluid, my blood fluids going throughout my body. And, I finally made it. And now I'm just like, wow, Hamilton was nothing compared to this. What is Africa gonna be like? And of course, with Africa, there was the physical pains, I would say, are incomparable to the sometimes the mental pain that you go through.
When you sort of did that 14-day hike to Montreal, did you carry 14 days worth of food or did you restock on the way and sort of stop by grocery stores and restock?
I stopped by grocery stores. What I did was there were times where there would be some places where there wouldn't be any grocery stores or restaurants or hotels. But I mean, we're largely talking about Ontario, which is a very it's a very developed province in Canada. And so there's going to be access to a lot of things. Surprisingly, not a lot of access of Wi-Fi signal. Sorry, not Wi-Fi signal, but cellular signal. In Africa, I found that there was way more cellular signals in more places than I was in rural parts of Canada, which was quite bizarre and interesting to learn about. Or perhaps it was just these particular routes that I happened to be on. But yeah, yeah.
Are you walking on like roads or like footpaths the whole way? Or are you walking on like sand and gravel? Or is it a mix of everything?
So the walk from Toronto to Montreal was a mix of a lot of different things, but it was mainly pavement. It was mainly road. I was on the highway for most of the times, and I knew that I would be on pavement for the majority of time in Africa as well. But of course, there would be maybe I would say like 15 to 20% of the trip would be off-road or in places that are essentially no roads at all. And if you think about it, like 15% makes up a huge chunk out of 18,000 kilometers. So, it's like it was pretty intense. So, but the walk to Montreal was, I would say, like quite easy. I think I hit gravel maybe once or twice. It was more about just the distance and learning pace, learning how to feed myself, fuel myself throughout the walk. It was just essentially training on that front. And it was also just learning how to ration my resources, how and when to drink water, learning compass, like using the compass to navigate. So it was really like it was a huge learning curve. So it was like probably the most intensive training I've ever done within 14 days.
Wow, talking about techniques, like I've sort of done a few sort of 8 hour hikes where it's like 4 hour one way, 4 hour return. I sort of just walk at it one step at a time and I pause to eat. I try to hydrate and drink as much water as possible. I usually do the hike in silence, but sometimes I listen to music. So there's like no really technique in my hike. When you're sort of doing it day to day, what are some of the key techniques that come with long distance walking?
There were a few times where I would listen to music. It didn't happen a lot. I started to listen to music maybe closer to the end of my journey. I would say the last 6 months of my walk, I would start listening to a little bit more music. At the beginning, I would focus more on my surroundings because, I was unaware. I was unaware of I guess the terrain, the environment, the culture. There were people who don't speak English, and so I didn't want to be in a vulnerable position where I'm not being fully aware of my surroundings. And I also used entertainment, as in music, as a way to boost me. And as like when you're driving a or racing a car, like in Fast One, sorry, what is it called? Fast and Furious. They put those little boosters on, right? And those boosters last for like 2 seconds, 5 seconds. And to me, that's what music would do. So out of a 14, 15-hour hike, I realized that I can't listen to music for more than 3.5 to 4 hours. There's no way. Like it just starts sounding like noise. That's like mashing your brain. Like it's just as it is, your brain just becomes numb to the sound. So no matter how, so I had to figure out how to sustain myself and use it as a, as a booster, like a booster drug, essentially. And I would typically do it near A, the end of a walk, if I were to do it at all, and closer to the end of my entire hike across Africa. And most of the time, it wouldn't even be music. I'd be listening to podcasts, and all these podcasts are just essentially learning some of the skills that I need to be learning, but also reframing and changing my mindset. So, listening to people like Alan Watts on, understanding the deepness of the mind in relation to the universe. Those things were things that kept me going because there's so much depth in understanding reality in a way that is as objective as you possibly can make it. You really start to use your mind at full capacity to try and understand all these different concepts that you're now learning. And so that would entertain me essentially on my walk. So if I'm learning something, it would sustain me.
Talking about Alan Watts, talking about how we're so tiny in the grand scheme of things and how, things don't really matter, life is short. With that perspective, do you really try to squeeze and make the most out of your one life and do as many crazy things as possible and just have it back to back and just like, man, if I have this one life and like it might as well be epic because like I don't know what happens afterwards and nothing really matters, so let's just go all out.
Well, I think you, whatever matters is what you make matter. So you can choose what you want to matter and what not. And I think at the end of the day, that's what you kind of figured out, is that everything is essentially a choice. It doesn't have to be this grand scheme. It doesn't have to be this very sophisticated idea of reality or fantasy. It's just whatever you want it to be, so long as, and the thing is, you can let it be whatever you want it to be, so long as you know how close it's linked to objective reality. Like if we put up a wall in front of you, and that's an objective physical object in front of you, that it's going to be very hard to go through that with your body. So that to me is the objective reality. And then you start approaching and understanding everything else in life in such the same way. That means, like education is another example. If I were to ask you the question, like, what is the best way to save humanity on planet Earth? What would be the answer? You know what I mean? It's a very, a lot of people have their ideal based on how they grew up, what the answer should be. And then there is also an answer that could best reflect the objective reality of what that answer can be, which is there are multiple different ways of approaching humanity reaching a state of a peace. And then again, once you reach, there's no such thing as 100% peace, because when there's 100% peace, that doesn't work that way. If there's no nighttime, there's no daytime, and there's no daytime, there's no nighttime. So I don't know. I'm rambling on.
Were there any sort of life discoveries or awakenings or sort of big shifts that you got after the 2.5 year sort of journey?
Mine was really thoughts and ideas that I've had before I went to Africa. Those were mainly, that I believe that people are inherently good. I think that we want to see the best for ourselves and others around us, whether they're close or distant from us. And I think that we are taught over time through fear to essentially leap out of our inherent goodness. We are taught, as an example, and this is very random, but that humanity had even gotten to this point. But instead of teaching kids ownership, of the toys that we possess, we could have taught kids, I could have been taught as a child, to hold on to a toy that was passed on by another kid, and then me taking care of that toy will I can then pass that on to the next kid and make that as a ceremonial kind of gesture for my community, for humanity, for a lot of things. It could probably solve a lot of things. Like, you know, if you teach children already this kind of shared mentality in a sense of when we're talking about economics, then we have like this shared economy. We could probably address a lot of issues that are happening right now where ownership of one person, like when one person owns one thing, when one person owns many things, you know, how does that relate to sustainability? And we could also change the definition of what we mean by economic health and probably prevent a lot of, I don't know, cruelty that's happened on planet Earth. And that's what I found in Africa, is that they have this real shared economy within a lot of the towns, a lot of the villages, a lot of the tribes that I've met. They have this, and it's such a beautiful gift that's still left on Earth. It's like this one, and there are many other communities around the world. I've seen like in Iran, El Salvador, those places. Unfortunately, these places, you know, are developing nations that suffer. And, you know, the argument is that because you're poor, you have no choice but to get along with each other kind of thing. So you tend to be more communal. But in Africa, it was just this really, even when I was in places like Nairobi and these like richer parts, there was still this real communal way of interacting with each other. We can say that, like, and it's not like a communal, like, what do you call it? Like socialism or communism, where everyone just kind of like come together and do the same thing. Everyone has their own individual way of being. It's just that they know that whatever strength they have, they could use that to help the other person, and that person's strength can help them in some sort of way. And I found that to be very natural over there. And I feel like when I went there, I learned that we have been distracted with thinking that this kind of Western way is the prominent way, is the only way and the most efficient way to live life, which it absolutely is not.
That's super duper cool. I was just sort of thinking back, I was in this country, New Caledonia, and I was invited to this sort of small tribe. You know, it wasn't like a tribal in Africa. Everyone had clothes and stuff, but they sort of stayed in these sort of like metal huts, and like none of them worked. None of them had jobs. I was like, how do you buy food? And they're like, you know, some neighbor might kill a deer and bring it back to the sort of the suburb or the village, and that's food for everyone for the week. And, you know, people chip in here and there. And if they really need food, they can always find food from a neighbor. And there wasn't sort of a need for everyone to get a job and move to the city. They somehow would just figure out life. They might go to markets, sell some things, and if they sold nothing, that's okay. If they sold, you know, one sandwich, which I, the tourist, bought, that's enough, you know, money for them to survive for the next few days. And there wasn't this pressure to sort of grind, clock in 9 to 5 every single day, and that they sort of had this weird subconscious where they like knew that, hey, like, I'll be okay. Like, there's people around me that can support me. And if someone needs help from me, I'm more than happy to say yes.
Absolutely. And on top of that, I mean, I feel like we're going full circle in terms of this kind of communal way of thinking, whether we like it or not. You know, with technological advancements, you know, artificial general intelligence and the Internet of Things, you know, everything is coming back together in a sense where humanity is like, okay, well, here's everybody in a, like, kind of like in a single village. That's where things are leading. And, you know, even if there are certain factions of the human population that are trying to escape that, I think it's inescapable. The Internet of Things brings everything together, where when one person learns a new skill or has knowledge of new findings, you know, in scientific research, healthcare, etc., then the whole world will know almost instantaneously. And this shared economy, you know, it coupled with autonomy in the workforce with robots and whatnot. But, you know, we saw Elon Musk kind of creating his robots that are far advanced beyond Boston Dynamics. And, you know, they've created robots for over a decade, and these guys just came up with this like literally 2 years ago.
Is this?
And they're going to put them in manufacturing plants. And then for manufacturing plants, they're going to go into commercial use. And then from commercial use, they'll go into private use. People will use them in their homes. And this is like only a decade away. So with more and more job losses and, you know, people saying like, well, there might be new opportunities for work, you know, sure, but the economy of scale is that there's less and less work being available. And that's going to continue happening. So I don't understand the, why we never plan for the, we never plan, it's weird, our society, we never plan for the end projection of where we're going. If we can understand and see the projection of exponential growth and technological advancements and, you know, robots replacing human jobs and whatnot, why can't we, why are we focused on, first of all, not even the future, but we're not even like at the present. You know, like government is not, hasn't established rules and laws for artificial intelligence yet. So it's, I'm getting back to my point, as in like, you know, we're coming full circle in the sense that we have to come back to this kind of village type mentality, because that's what it's going to be eventually with a higher population. But even that is, we know that the population will cap at 11,000 and then it rapidly decline again. So, and I feel like Africa is probably the most, is the continent that will transition into what we call the third or fourth industrial revolution, I think easier than most continents on the planet. I feel like maybe China, you know, maybe like, you know, South Korea and whatnot, but I believe that Africa has an opportunity to completely start from a clean slate if given the opportunities and they seize those opportunities.
Mario, how hard has it been to sort of turn sort of the exploration and your lifestyle into a living and sort of do it full time? Like, for example, prior to your 2.5 year walk, was there a lot of prep when it came to sort of getting sponsors, getting camera gear, figuring out if you had to, were you going to be posting live? How hard or what has it been like to turn this into a career?
So I didn't get sponsors until I reached Ethiopia on my journey. And because I actually did something what at the time I thought was such a noble act, where I said, I'm not doing this for sponsorships or anything like that. I'm doing this entirely on my own, which is not true. I, you know, I had a lot of people support me financially, and I had people along the way who gave me homes for me to sleep in. So, you know, it took a village for me to get across. It wasn't just me. It was literally maybe hundreds of people who involved themselves in getting me across Africa. But yeah, sorry, you have to, what was the question again? I went way off.
The general question is like, how hard is it to sort of, has it been for you, or maybe it's not hard to sort of make
What
this
was
a
the
living?
question? So the transition, I feel like it happened very naturally. And by saying that, I mean I was very lucky. I was incredibly lucky to have the support. You know, as soon as I think I made it to Egypt, you know, it started going all over the news. It almost went like viral. People started picking it up left, right, and center all over Africa. So it was really popular in Africa. People started to actually even recognize me throughout Sudan, Egypt, and parts of Ethiopia as well. Just walking around, people had literally recognized me, and I thought that, wow, where is this coming from? And that's because I was doing a lot of interviews with newscasters. I was on podcasts, radio shows. I did a TEDx talk. And you know, and then there were some influencers with who have millions of followers who had featured me on their stories as well, like Nas Daily. And so those things kind of like, I guess, propelled me in a way. And that's not necessarily where the social media and I would say like that's not where the exponential growth happened. It was just like a very slow, I think it took about 3 to 4 years for me to finally get to the place where I'm at right now. I think I had to, a lot to do with COVID and with the BLM movement. There was like a huge, yeah, there was a huge uptake in people getting like, you know, going on social media a lot more often and looking for more meaningful and deep stories. And I think that's when my career in this field started to exponentially grow. And during that time, I also traveled quite a lot to places that allowed travel during COVID times.
Is the sort of schedule of like an explorer, is it like every 2 or 3 years you plan this sort of big campaign that you try to get sponsors for and have it all be sort of covered? And then in between those big trips and planning, you're sort of doing as many speaking gigs as possible. Maybe you have a book. Is that still sort of the exploration sort of life?
So that's the traditional route. And I think the more modern route is just mixing that in with the social media. And so I do have my big expeditions every 2 or 3 years. I try to push for an expedition every year, but kind of like falls through your fingers like sand. So unfortunately, those things are difficult to come by. Not every expedition makes it on the shelf, or some expeditions just get shelved. So 2 or 3 years, I think, is the Goldilocks, because you have time to recover and you have time to promote your last expedition. You have time to write your book. And I think where I am right now is trying to figure out how to become more efficient in terms of time management and writing books, but also producing content and planning expeditions that are meaningful, that again circle back to eco exploration as well. So the quicker I can turn those things around, the more passion projects I can fulfill.
2 months ago, I was in a trip in Mongolia, and then my last recent trip was in Tasmania, Australia. And when I was in Mongolia, it's sort of more of like a developing sort of third world country. I'm on edge, I'm switched on, I'm like wary, I'm trying to, I don't speak the local language, and it's sort of like a challenge. I'm like, I'm on edge. Whereas when I was in Tasmania, the sort of island at the bottom of Australia, everyone speaks English. I'm in my local country. I can use my credit cards, and there wasn't that sort of added stress, or I wasn't on edge. Obviously, there was a lot of hiking. I did a lot of exploring, but do you crave sort of going to third world countries and having that type of experience since you've did 2.5 years of that? What type of sort of countries or environments do you sort of crave when it comes to exploring?
If we're talking about cultural, like going into a cultural dive, for sure. Visiting places that have a long history, long ancient history, and it's still fully entrenched today. I love going to places like that where you can see the individual character of people that reflects the culture as well. But I also do enjoy, I think it's just, I enjoy the challenge of being able to maneuver myself in situations that I am unfamiliar with. So that could be anything. It could be cultural, it could be environmental, it could be crossing a desert to climbing a mountain, to kayaking across Great Lakes around the world. So, it's just, it doesn't matter really what it is. I just love like basically embodying the ultimate challenge.
Mario, when you sort of walked through like the deserts, like how did you restock on food and water? Were you like, did you have an animal with you that carried a bunch of food? Or how did you do that on your 2 feet?
Yeah, so I never restocked. So what you do is in Sudan, I actually made friends with this guy. His name is Levison Wood, an incredible explorer, English explorer. And he kept in contact with me, and he said, if you need any help or support along the way, please reach out. So he's the first person to walk the entire length of the River Nile, so from source to finish. And and largely I did that route starting from Sudan. I essentially followed his route. So I just basically just copied his route and did what he did. And he purchased camels in this village in northern Sudan, where basically you buy a camel for, say, $2,000. What they do is they have this herd of camels that cross the part of the desert, the White Desert, from one village to the next, where they do exchange and kind of selling the camels in this other village. And so by the time you get to the other side of the village, by the way, you never ride this camel. You hardly ever see it. This camel just carries your water supplies. And by the time you get to the other village across the desert, which could take anywhere from a week to a week and a half, for me, it took about a week and a half. You resell that camel if you want your money back, but you get half of that money back because the camel's weighing like it's lost like 40% of its weight.
Wow, that's really cool.
Or you could stick around, feed the camel, gain the weight back, but then you lose more money sticking around in the village, feeding yourself and the camel. You know what I mean? So there's always like these balances that like you have to make quick and concise decisions.
Mario, with your five sort of near-death experiences in Africa, how many of them involved people, and how many of them were you all alone?
Good question. Few, I would say fewer from people. Like I would say there was like one incident where only one out of the 2.5 years, the only one where it was people, and that was me getting shot at across in Mozambique. The other ones with people, it's a hard line. I mean, yes, I could have been hurt and whatnot, but it wasn't a direct action towards me. It was more like a warning or like a scare. If that makes any sense. But getting shot at by rebel, like these people truly wanted to end my life. That's different. In terms of the environment, I would say the environment probably was the biggest culprit, and dehydration and myself. So essentially, what the limit of the human body, as well as being unprepared. So I would say most of my near-death experience was me being unprepared because of the environment.
Wow. So in the periods of dehydration, you just probably ran out of water until you could get to the next place where you can get water, and you just kept pushing through. What happened in those situations? How did you get to that next location, hallucinating, and how did you stay like alive?
So there's one lesson I learned, which was probably the most important lesson that I've ever learned, which is when things start getting really dicey, stay calm, sit down, stay calm, breathe slowly, and start to think of solutions. And so for me, that's every time I put myself or I found myself in a harmful situation, a dire situation, I would stay calm and think about all the different survival scenarios I learned for that specific region. So for each place that I would go to, I already knew sort of what I'm supposed to do. So if I went along the Transkei coast in South Africa, which is also called the Wild Coast, I already knew that which animals could kill me, which would more likely attack me. So I already have like all these different ideas of what could happen to me before it happens. And so, okay, now you got that. Now the second thing is, well, how do I get myself out of a situation if, say, for instance, baboons came in the hordes and decided to attack me? And that did happen. And so you build a fire with a lot of smoke, and that's it. Or you make yourself big, but then you could be starting a fight. So the best thing you want to do is create avoidance, or having a mosquito bite, which also happened. And I got cerebral malaria, which is the worst kind of malaria you can get. If not treated, you will have cerebral brain damage, which could be permanent. And so to prevent that, you wear long sleeves as much as possible, and you try to get shelter before 6 o'clock, when you know that those mosquitoes tend to come out at those times for outbreaks, but you can never predict it. So what you're really doing is, it's not about a 100%. You're like, well, I need to survive at least as much as I possibly can. Being on the coastal regions of South Africa, for instance, it sounds like a beachy trip, but you're actually in a trap where you can't go inland because it's too much bush going too far. We're talking hundreds of kilometers before civilization. You can't go out into the treacherous ocean. We're talking about the Indian Ocean. It's like really rough and wild here. You can't go back because that's also hundreds of kilometers back. The only way is to keep going forward. And when you realize that you're in trouble, that can get very scary. That gets very, very scary. And for me, the scariest thing was my own mind, really. Preventing yourself from going insane is that was another thing that I had to overcome as well. I would say that's a survival technique, which is to a survival tactic to be able to be calm in the mind when you should be kind of freaking out.
It's crazy. Like when I was in New Caledonia, I sort of went on this hike. I got lost. Sun was setting. Sort of, I ended up being stuck on the mountain. I sort of had a map on my phone, but that didn't give me much context. I knew that I had to just follow the river back to the shoreline, and that's where the road would be. And every time, as I'm following the river, every 100 meters there'll be a waterfall, so I had to go up, down, and it was like I was wearing shorts. I had no food, but I had the river for water. But I sort of knew that, I heard you can go 5, 6 days without food. So I knew that, what, like, even though it would suck and I was already 2 days in, like, if I just keep going, I would make it out alive. But then there'll be other instances, like I'm driving down this highway and sort of like I did this road trip to the middle of Australia and I overtook a truck and it ended up being a truck with two trailers and the road was a straight road but it was a hill and I sort of overtook and I got back in just before the peak of the hill and if there was an incoming car, I probably would have died. And it's crazy how that was like, it was a short sort of like 30 second near death experience, and that was completely reliant on luck. That shook me more than the New Caledonia stuck on the mountain experience. Despite me being safe in a car, I was not scratched, I was not torn up, I was not hungry. I was in a car, I just survived because of luck, and that scared me much, much more than gone for 2 days without food and trying to figure my way back to sort of the road.
Well, in a way, I mean, luck can run for anything at any time, anywhere, at any place with anyone. Essentially, what you're doing with this whole passing the truck is, you're betting. You're making a bet. And sometimes it's okay to make it, obviously, because you're here and you're fine. I've made a few bets and I've been lucky. So, but I definitely don't rely on that. I think that people who explore or who go on adventures in such a way are reckless and it can be very dangerous, especially to other people as well, if other people are joining you. But I have wagered huge bets on my own life one time, a few times actually, and those are usually during times when I'm vulnerable. Where I, like, for instance, I haven't eaten food for 2 days, or I'm dehydrated, I'm hallucinating. Then you start like, okay, let me just do this and see what, like, this has to be good. Because betting can, it's almost like lazy because you didn't want to wait behind the truck. You could have just waited, but you're like, nope, impatient. And it's harder to be patient than it is to be impatient. So having a grip on your mind is I think that is the key to survival. And it's okay if it like happens once in the blue moon, you can like, start betting on small things, but when it comes to your life and other people's lives, I can see why one would do it. I understood why I did it, and I don't know why you did it, but there must be a reason why you did it.
Yeah, I think I just miscalculated. I was like overtaking many cars successfully. One, I miscalculated it being an upward hill, so the horizon was much shorter than it was because it was, it would go up so you can't see past the hill. And two, from behind, I thought it was just a truck with one carriage, but it was a truck with two carriage. So it was a double miscalculation, and only because of luck, there was no car coming towards me. And like I hated I was so angry at myself that like, man, like I only made of that out of that because of luck. And yes, I'm in the middle of the desert. The chances of you only see an incoming car once every 15 minutes. So like the chances of dying were pretty slim, but still like that, I had to rely on that slim chance not happening, and that like pissed me off more than, being lost in the forest.
Right. No, yeah, no, I totally understand that. I mean, I'll tell you my last kind of survival story. I'll tell you one more
Please.
survival story. And so this was the river crossing, and I had walked 15 hours eventually to get to this water crossing. I didn't know it was there. I looked on the map. It was never on the map. So, obviously these rivers can form overnight. I finally made it to this river, and across the river there was like white smoke coming out. It looked like from a chimney. So I knew that there was civilization there. I knew there were people there. But the night before that, I was suffering from hyperthermia. My tent had broken apart because of like some crazy storm winds, and I was in a valley. It was really like super wild experience. And I was dodging baboons. So by the time I made it to this river, I was like, man, I just want to cross this river. I just want to get to this destination. So I did much like what you did, is I misjudged the severity of the situation I was getting into. And I paid not the ultimate price, but I paid a price hard enough that made me think differently moving forward from this point on. This is in South Africa, so maybe this incident itself is what saved my life for the remainder of the journey. So by the time I got to this river, usually what I do is I had an inflatable boat that I just kind of like deflate, roll up, put in my backpack, and when I need it, I would inflate it, put my backpack on the boat, tie a rope around my waist. I would dive into the water from this river, whether it's going in or out, and into the ocean. These rivers are massive. Like, we're talking like some of them were like half a football field wide. And you're going some distance. And not only that, but if you're swimming across, you're also doing this, right? Because the water is carrying you down or upstream. And this one here was taking me out into the water, and I misjudged the depth of the water. I thought I could just walk across the water. For some weird reason, I don't know why. I put the backpack above my head, and I took a risk, and I said, "All right, here you go. I'm gonna take a step." As soon as I took the first step, it's just like the water is just somehow just like we're talking like black water. Like, it's just so dark, and nighttime is approaching, and this water is just it just sucked me. That like just straight under. And now, like, all of a sudden, like, I remember like taking a step, and the second thing I remember was just like being like twirled around underwater, heading out into the ocean, knowing that I know that there are bullshit, like, I don't know what kind of sharks, but I know that there are sharks doing figure eight, waiting for fresh fish, and I'm amongst maybe something that they want to taste or try. And I was like, man, this is like, I don't think there's a hospital anywhere nearby. This is ridiculous. I fought and I fought and I fought, tried to get up. And I remember not even having enough time to take a breath to capture air. So I remember just sinking and kind of panicky, just trying to get up, up, up. And eventually I got to the top, and I remember again some advice from a village before, where this guy said, if a tide takes you out, if a river takes you out into the ocean, just be calm. There's no way you can fight the tide, the current. So just allow yourself to float, and either it's going to take you left or it's going to take you right, because it comes out and curls, right? So hope to God it takes you to the destination where you want to go to. Unfortunately for me, it took me back to the beginning of where I started. So now I'm just like, man, I just saw my life flash before my eyes. I just like I swallowed like probably a gallon of water, and now I gotta do it again. And now it's nighttime. Now it's raining hard. It's colder. I'm in a more severe situation. It's a desperate situation now. So I had to redo what I did before, but the proper way. And that's like the ultimate slap in the face. Like, nope, you gotta do it the proper way. Do it the way that you would survive. And so I finally did that. When I did it the proper way, I jumped into the water, I swam across as quickly as I could, and I went, and I finally, when I felt the bottom of the other side, I ran so fast up the shore, and I remember I dropped on my knees, and I screamed and yelled so loud. It was just like a roar. And I think that was like the most animalistic I ever felt in my life. Like, just pure, I just survived that. And just to finish the story off, I finally found what this chimney was all about, where the smoke was coming from. Apparently, it was an eco lodge that's not on the map of these, super wealthy white Afrikaans, white South African people who were just staying at this eco lodge. And I arrived at the hotel, after climbing a hill to get there. I'm like muddy, dirty, I'm like wet, and I show up. Only black guy. These people have a history with black and whites there. So I knew The tension was going to be high. And I show up, I'm dripping, and everyone at the restaurant just stops. There were like 20, 25, 30 people. Everyone just stops, they stare at me. And the owner finally comes up to me. He's like, "Where have you just come from?" And I was like, "I just crossed the river. I'm doing a hike across South Africa." And they all looked at me like they're just in awe. And the guy comes to me. He's like, "You, my bro, cross this river. Every year, two people die from this river trying to cross it. You, my friend, had crossed it at nighttime." And because of that, this guy gave me a place to stay for 2 nights. I got to stay at this luxurious place for 2 nights with all the food. It was like, it's such an incredible experience. I mean, yeah, it was like such a highlight of my trip. I would say that's definitely the story that like lives with me forever.
That's so freaking epic, Mario. I guess one, when you're sort of getting thrown down the lake, were you still holding onto all your things? And did you have all your food by the end when you got to back to the beginning? And two, what was the correct way to cross the river and what did you do incorrectly the first time?
Yeah, I had all my food in a little like a water like a compression bag, and so nothing really got wet except for the outside of the bag. Unfortunately, my camera gear did get wet, so it ruined my camera gear. So my the stint of high quality photos and videos ended there on my trip. So then it was just passive iPhone 5 photos. Which was still good at the time, I guess. So the first incorrect thing that I did was I judged a river by thinking I could just walk across it. Never make that judgment with any river, especially if it's wider than you are. So and this was a size of this was like I would say like not a huge a wide river. I would say like maybe like 20 meters of like it was wide but not the widest and like you would see, but it was still dangerous enough being at nighttime, the speed at which it was going, and knowing that there's crocodile upstream, and then knowing that there are sharks in the ocean doing figure eights who wait for fresh fish to come out. So the incorrect way is to try and walk it and to not understand the depth of the river, the speed at which the river is moving, flowing the water. You have to know all these things. So you have to know where you should launch from and where you most likely will end. So I didn't make those judgments before, and I think it's mainly because I was desperate and I was looking for a shortcut. And the correct way was to go upstream, strip off my clothes, put it all in the backpack, put the backpack onto the inflatable boat, tie it around my waist, and just kind of jump into the water as quickly as humanly possible and swim across. And I'm a pretty strong swimmer, so for me, that I could easily do that.
Being sort of beating death so many times, do you have a relationship with either God, the universe? How has that changed your relationship with the universe, I guess?
That's a good question. Yeah, I would say that I fall more in line with non-religious for sure. Before I did this trip, I was actually not religious, but I was looking for something. I was looking for like an answer of who are we, why are we here, and what's my place in the universe. And of course, I never found these answers until I started like searching for them myself through other people, through stories, through experiences. I would say the closest my beliefs aligned with what would be traditional Buddhist philosophies in terms of, because I feel like Buddhist philosophy is more focused on realities than fictitious fantasies. And when you're in a world where you get to experience so many people acting out fictitious fantasies, or it could be their own realities. However, it is still so many different realities, and you get to experience them that you're no longer left with your own. Like everyone is so well content with their own belief that one person would believe what they believe as strongly as the other person. There's no fighting that. And so I thought that that's a silly game that we're all trying to outcompete each other. Like, okay, cool. So you win today, and then tomorrow you're gonna lose. It's gonna keep going back and forth. It doesn't make any sense. It just essentially holds us back when I believe that there's so much beauty in nature. I believe there's so much beauty in, in ourselves and everything else in the universe as well. I think it's the most fascinating story that no book could ever even come close to describing.
Prior to that New Caledonia trip and still now after, I don't believe there's like a man looking over us. But like, when I was in that forest, it's nighttime, it's raining, I'm just short sleeve, it's so cold, I'm on a hill, so I can't lie down flat. And I'm just like so down and hungry, and I just found myself just like praying. I'm like, man, like God, or if there's someone up there, like please, like get me out of this safely. And if you do, I promise to do as much good in this world as possible with the time you then give me. Just like, please get me out of this situation. What did you find yourself doing, or what state of mind were you at in periods of sort of like difficulty?
I think it also might depend on what stage you are when it comes to dying. There are different stages. There's a stage of like, oh, okay, you just realized that you could die. And then there's the stage of I am dying now. So I've been in this stage of I am dying a few times, and it's a very wow, that is it's a deep, it's a very deep, deep, deep moment. It's a kind of moment that it literally changes your mindset. For me, just a long story short, just to get to the point, I was dehydrated and I passed out, thought I was gonna die. And through this passing out, I had like glimpses of consciousness, and I remember just knowing that I was dying, and when you're in that stage, it's like, and I know it's part of the hallucination of dehydration, and like when people freeze to death too, is you have this like kind of angelic kind of experience. So I had that experience, and what it taught me, I was never looking for a God, which is funny enough. I never looked for God. I never looked for a higher purpose. I allowed myself to be as present in the moment as I possibly could be. And what that brought about was the realization of my connectedness to everything in the universe. And that allowed me to no longer fear death. That was the last time I ever feared death.
That is so beautiful. When you sort of get to these near-death experience and you sort of make it out, I like, wow, like I can't believe I made it out. This is an epic story, and there's so much adrenaline, you feel so pumped. Or are you more like, wow, that was pretty close, I don't want to push myself that far again, like I don't want to get near, like I don't want to be in that situation ever again, or like anything similar? So which bucket do you feel like you fall in?
I'd say that the bucket is half full for both sides. Like the crossing the river, as I said, I celebrated, I yelled, I did I did the loudest roar that I could have ever done. So I felt this like incredible euphoric sense of achievement in a sense, because it's like real achievement in the sense that I had to complete this specific task. I made it across, and that task was to live. To make it across and live. And so I did that. And there's no clearer task than that. So it's very simple for the mind to understand. So I had that feeling that the first thing that you said, and the second part, oh, am I gonna do this again? It's not that I wouldn't do it again. I never thought I wouldn't do this again. It's more like, okay, well, now I have to be way more prepared the next time I do this. And so that's how my brain thinks. It's like constantly recalibrating and trying to figure out and understand how to do it better the next time.
And then, Mara, do you crave sort of challenges and sort of these sort of very dicey situations where, like, let's say you do a campaign, you do a road trip around the country, and nothing bad happens, you're safe, you're in control the whole time. You're like, man, like, I want to push it a bit further on the next challenge because what happened in the previous sort of expedition, that really got my adrenaline flowing. Or are you pretty happy with sort of safe as planned expeditions?
I'm happy with the safe planned expeditions. You can only push your luck so many times. But I think what I try to tweak, and I think you can't really beat crossing Africa. That's just like a That's a next level expedition. It's a trip that I'll remember for the rest of my life. Like every moment that I went through in Africa could essentially be like a highlight moment in a book, right? So I think what I look forward to is planning meaningful and purposeful expeditions that I think make me feel like I have a sense of purpose and something I can bring back to humanity.
That's beautiful. On your Africa trip, is there a story of you really doing a bet where you had no control? It was like the outcome was not something you physically or could even talk your way out of. It was a complete bet where you're like fingers crossed.
Oh yeah. I would say crossing the desert was one of those experiences. Although it's been done before, I was left alone for most of it. So if I had taken one step off the path, I would probably not know how to find my path back on the main road. And no one would be able to find me. I'd just be buried in sand. And then I'd be forgotten, and that's it. And I just couldn't help but think the number of people who are buried under the sand that I stand on. So, I mean, that's just one that I just thought of right off the bat. But there are so many other experiences as well.
Is there a story that you could share about your experiences with animals? What's the sort of like a story that comes to my mind? And like you mentioned baboons a few times, like that's insane. Like I haven't seen a baboon in real life. I haven't seen one of them in the zoo. And the fact that that's something you have to sort of deal with is pretty crazy. Yeah.
It's seeing animal, like I've never seen an elephant before, like even at a zoo, I don't think I've seen an elephant close up before. And the first, yeah, and my first close-up experience happened to be with a large Mozambican bull elephant. And those are massive. I think they're the largest elephants in the world with the massive tusks. And this was I knew this was a because again, you got to know you got to know what animals are in your in the areas that you're going to and know how to survive the situation. So, they taught me that if an elephant does come and attack you, just don't run. There's nothing you can do. However, you can play psychological games. You can kind of just tell the elephant to essentially fuck off, and the elephant will kind of understand that because animals have a their survival tactic is mostly on instinct, and that instinct comes from millions of years of adaptation, evolution, et cetera, et cetera. So if you do certain things that the animal is not a like, whoa, what is that? It would bet against going into that situation because it's not like they have hospitals and nurses, sorry, hospitals and doctors in the wild. So the best survival tech for any animal is to avoid things that aren't very usual. But if you are unusual and you act as prey, then they will say, this is unusual, but I'm hungry or I'm angry, so I'm gonna take my rage out on or my hunger out on this person. So yeah, so you have to play these psychological and you have to do it immediately. You have to like know that that's what you have to do on the spot, and you can only do that if when you're calm.
And what went down in your situation? Was the elephant hungry and angry? What did you do to act unusual?
So this was along the route in southern Mozambique. I think this was like 3 days walking through Mozambique, now crossing the South African border. And I went to this there was this wild elephant sanctuary. And apparently these elephants, like they have no gates or fences. It's just you're in the jungle. Not in the jungle, sorry, you're in whatever. I think it's like a mix of jungle slash forest slash I don't so like it didn't make any sense, but there are tall trees. And so I'm like walking. I was by myself, I remember, completely alone. And this is a mud road, and I remember seeing this like massive tree just kind of shaking in a very unnatural way. I thought to myself, what tree just moves like that? That's impossible. There's no way. Like a tree that's like twice as the width of me, it's just moving like a twig. And then I just heard like a like someone like a snot like just like that. And I remember like I felt like a ghost like just kind of escaped my body. Like it's like my spirit didn't want to be a part of this, and I just was like I had to go into auto mode. And I remember like looking carefully and I didn't want to stare for too long because I felt I was mostly scared that if I give eye contact to whatever is behind that tree, that it would attack me at that very moment, which is sort of what animals do. But I had to keep my ground. I remember seeing this massive, massive elephant, just like taller than anything I've ever seen, behind a tree. It was doing, I guess what they do is they use their tusks against the trees to whatever, and they break the branches and whatnot. So it was just doing that. But I remember it was like sweating through its ears, nose, mouth. So it was sweating through its adrenal glands. And that's the sign that it's a teenage male bull elephant. And usually they are like extremely aggressive because they're trying to assert themselves in, their own societies. So he was just trying to intimidate. He was just like going like, trying to push the tree. Like, look what I can do. You better stay far away from me. And oh man, I remember being so scared. But I remember putting my hand out like this and going like, hey boy, easy. And I'm walking backwards. This is like across the road, but we're talking a very narrow mud road. And I didn't even see that thing until it was too late. And that was the closest encounter. That was so dangerous. It probably wasn't the closest encounter, but it was definitely an encounter that it freaked me out the most. And I just like I let my body escape, my mind escape, and I let my body just do the automatic work it needed to do. That was it.
And you slowly walked away, and you found another way, another route around.
No, I stayed the same route. This was the same road. There's only one little road there. And I stayed on the road. I just kind of kept walking. I went past it, right? And only when I was like essentially across from it is when I realized that this is a massive giant elephant right across me. That's like the same length as the elephant itself. And I'm like, this is it's like, how did I get myself in this situation? So I also felt stupid. I felt like, man, like I need to be way more careful. And that's when I started walking backwards now and facing it the entire time, going like, easy boy, and keep walking until I realized that eventually it just didn't care anymore. And then I just turned my back. And
Wow.
then as soon as I turned my back, because I knew that the situation was safe, it's like it never even happened. Like I didn't even think about it. I just moved on naturally.
Oh my God. That's crazy. Mario, could you also share one story about the different experiences you've had with bullets being shot at you? You said one time it was aimed at you, other times it was warning shots. Like, why did this happen? Why were people sort of hostile against you? And how did you get past and continue on your journey if that was in your way?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you the story in in South Africa. I think everybody knows the one in Mozambique. There's videos of it and whatnot. There was this one time in South Africa where I was what I would do is essentially sleep in people's farms, which is apparently illegal. It's they call them squatters, but I wasn't really a squatter, but they were comparing me to a squatter, and squatters were a lot of Black South Africans who would sleep on white farmers' land, A, because the land was taken away from them, or B, they're planning to attack them. So there's been killings and attacks in these areas. And I think these are revenge attacks by Black South Africans against the white South Africans. And of course, from a distance, I look like a Black South African. So I remember this one farmer with his son, and I was sleeping in my tent. And all I heard is like, hey boy, you must get out of here now, eh? And I was like, ah, oh, this is not good. I felt like this is gonna be a march into me being hung. Like it was just really scary how just witnessing real racism, witnessing someone that would enjoy murdering you and looking them in the eye, hearing their voices, that is such a haunting experience. I don't wish that for anybody really, like not one single soul to ever experience someone, another human being wanting to murder you just because of literally your skin color. And but in South Africa, I think it's even beyond just the skin color. It's also if you're ethnically South African. And I remember this guy, he came out of his truck with his son, and his son was beside him, and I kept thinking, like, man, I do this stuff to inspire young kids. And there's this one kid, he's just like looking up to his dad, and be probably happy to have him shoot me. And so I didn't want that story to end there. So I had to convince them. As soon as I spoke, sorry, before I spoke, he gave me a shotgun warning. Like, it was a boom, and I was like, whoa, this is like too much. It's too much. I'm like, I'm in my tent. And so I come out, and he looked actually more scared than I was. And that's the part where I was just like, whoa, what the hell is going on right now? He looked more afraid than I was afraid. However, he had a gun, and that's the difference. It's like, I don't know if you read all of Yuval Harari's books or his quotes, the author of Sapiens and Homo Deus. I'm not saying this verbatim, but he was essentially coined the phase where he said that humans are essentially sheep with like rocket launchers on them. As soon as we get spooked, poof, we just like press the button. And that's what I thought when I saw this guy. I'm like, man, you're spooked by these black people because you murdered them in mass, and now they remember that you murdered their parents, and their siblings. And so of course you're scared for your life. And so you saw me, and immediately you probably thought I'm out here to do harm. But as soon as I started speaking, he heard my accent, and he realized, that I'm a foreigner visiting. And then he had a look at my tent and all the kind of stuff that I had. And, I reassured him that, I'm safe and I'll leave in the morning. That was a very strange encounter. I've had those multiple times. That, like, basically I'm telling you this one story, but that happened throughout the time in South Africa.
And those stories were all sort of racism-based stories, white people thinking that you were sort of hostile, and it wasn't like a tribe or like a sort of, what do you call them? A group of people trying to do you harm. It was sort of like individuals.
Exactly. Yeah. Well,
Wow.
I do have to say, I do have to bounce. It's 5:30 on my side.
We'll wrap it up. One, thank you so much for your time, Mara. Where can people find more and get more of your stories and just get more you and just hear more about the crazy experiences that you've had so far?
Yeah, thank you. If you can go to my Instagram, which is at Mario Rigby, or my website, which is www.mariorigby.com. Mario Rigby, like my website, obviously has the full details and blogs of all my expeditions, and Instagram has my kind of day-to-day kind of like life, and also preparations for my expeditions as well.
That's amazing, Mara. Thank you so much for your time today. It was so amazing just hearing all these sort of stories. You're sort of like this massive book where, I can just dig for hours and hours. And it's just because you're such a humble person. So I really appreciate your time today. And it was just so much fun hearing about all these lessons and then digging into the stories. So thank you, Mara.
Thank you. And yeah, I appreciate it. And thank you for having my story and continuing to share that. Appreciate it very much.
Guys, if you made it this far, hopefully you guys got value from this episode. Please let me know your thoughts. Drop a review on Spotify and Apple and just let me know your thoughts. Send me a message. And yeah, hopefully you guys got value today, and I'll see you guys next week with another episode. Peace.